from the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School. This is Knowledge at Wharton on Business Radio. Here's your host, Dan Loney.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Knowledge at Wharton here on Sirius XM 132, Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. Thanks for spending part of your day with us. It is the 13th of June. Great having you joining us wherever you're listening around the United States or up into Canada. Coming up on today's show, at the top, a letter in the New York Times just a few days ago highlighted over 180 CEOs who said that abortion bans like the ones in Alabama, Georgia, and other states are, quote, bad for business, end quote. We're going to discuss the push by these companies and others to use their platform to have an impact on social issues being brought into the political sphere. Then in about 30 minutes, we're joined by CNBC cybersecurity reporter Kate Fazzini, who has written a book looking at the arena she reports on. It is titled Kingdom of Lies, Unnerving Adventures in the World of Cybercrime. She'll join us at 10:30 Eastern Time. Then in hour number two, the act of declawing cats is considered by many pet owners to be gruesome. Now a bill to outlaw declawing of cats has passed the New York State legislature, and awaits a signature by Governor Andrew Cuomo, which would make New York the first state with such a law. They're not the first entity to have one, but we're going to look at this bill and how it may start a greater push for similar laws in other states. And then in our final 30, we'll have the latest on Boeing and the grounding of the Max or the 737 Max aircraft. Plus, Boeing is getting ready for the Paris Air Show next week. That's the annual big sales event for airplane manufacturers. But could the grounding of the 737 MAX hurt Boeing's sales at that event? We'll talk about that around 11:30 Eastern Time. All of that over the 2 hours of our show. The way for you to join in is either by phone at 844-WHARTON, 844-942-7866. Or if you'd like, send us a comment on Twitter at BizRadio, B-I-Z Radio 132, or my Twitter account, which is at Dan Loney, L-O-N-E-Y 21. First, though, here's what you need to know from today's business headlines. Two oil tankers have been evacuated in the Gulf of Oman near the Iranian coastline after reports of explosions. The cause of the fires is unknown, but the explosions on both ships occurred at roughly the same time, stoking fears of an attack. Target is expanding its same-day delivery options. Now customers can pay a $9.99 flat fee for same-day delivery on over 65,000 items. The service is going to be available in 47 U.S. states. Target already had same-day delivery through a company called Shipt that it purchased back in 2017. That service requires a $99 annual membership. Cybersecurity firm CrowdStrike had a good first day trading publicly on Wall Street. Its IPO price was $34 a share, and it ended the day at $58. Lululemon beating estimates at $0.74 per share profit last quarter. Revenue beat estimates at $782 million, and comparable store sales were up 16%. The apparel brand also increased its full-year profit forecast. And RH, the parent of home furnishings retailer Restoration Hardware, beat quarterly estimates easily with profit of $1.85 a share. Revenue beat also. RH did note that it had raised some prices on items due to the China tariffs. CEOs and corporations are taking more public stances on political issues lately. On Monday, a letter appeared in the New York Times, signed by over 180 CEOs, including Jack Dorsey of Square and Jeremy Stoppelman of Yelp, in opposition of strict abortion laws being enacted in states like Alabama and Georgia. The letter stated, quote, "Equality in the workplace is one of the most important business issues of our time. When everyone is empowered to succeed, our companies, our communities, and our economy are better for it," end quote. Companies have also recently taken a stance on gun control. Earlier this year, a group of CEOs sent a letter to Congress urging the passage of a bill that would require background checks for all gun sales. And recently, Silicon Valley tech giant Salesforce banned customers that sell certain types of weapons from using its software. So why are CEOs willing to risk taking these kinds of strong positions on political issues, and will it make a difference? Eric Ort's in studio with me, professor of legal studies and business ethics here at the Wharton School. And also joining us on the phone, Thomas Lyon, Chair of Sustainable Science, Technology, and Commerce at the University of Michigan School of Environmental and Sustainability, and a professor of business economics and public policy at the Ross School of Business. Eric, great to see you again. Thanks for coming in.
Good to be here.
Great. Thanks for coming in. Thomas, great to have you with us today.
Yeah, good to be here.
Thank you. Many people, I guess, Eric, are probably wondering why CEOs haven't been taking these stances more often going back in time, 20, 30, 40 years.
Well, I think, in fact, many CEOs have taken stands like that over time. So, you know, we can go back in history and think of examples. But I think the in the contemporary situation, we've become used to the idea that companies only care about maximizing their profits and it doesn't really matter what the political context is. But you don't have to go back too far in history to realize that that is a relatively recent phenomenon. So what that model, which you know many companies still follow today, that model assumes that you basically have a rule of law system in place that allows businesses to basically be autonomous and not to really worry on an everyday basis what the political situation is or on particular issues. There's going to be a tendency for companies to remain neutral because if you have consumers on both sides of the issue or employees on both sides of an issue, then it's not going to make sense from a business point of view to weigh in on the issue.
And I'm guessing this is part of what you had done a book a couple of years ago, The Moral Responsibility of Firms, which you co-edited. I'm guessing this is part of what you were talking about in that book as well.
Yeah, and in that book, we co-edited a book on what is moral responsibility when you think about firms. And there's really two, if you look at most business ethicists and philosophers and others who are concerned, there's basically two schools of thought. One is that corporations themselves should have a moral responsibility. And another one is that the leaders themselves, CEOs, have moral responsibility. So there's not really a question about whether there is it makes sense to think about moral responsibility, but really where does it lie? Where is the source of that? On these issues, you were raising a somewhat different question, and Tom Lyon, who we have on here, is a good friend from Michigan, is a co-author of a new piece. He can talk more about this, but he's coined the phrase. He and his co-authors have coined the phrase corporate political responsibility as well as corporate moral responsibility. So that's somewhat that's somewhat contradictory to this idea, well, businesses, shouldn't they just remain neutral? I think the idea here is on some issues, you really can't afford to remain neutral. You have to take a side. And just to take one other example, in addition to the ones you started the hour with, started the program with describing, think of Hong Kong's situation right now. Uh-huh. So you have a lot of people, according to some estimates, one in seven residents of Hong Kong are in the streets because they're worried that a law will be passed to extradite them to China. But that's an example where they're concerned about the rule of law issues. And there, if you're a business on the ground, you basically have to take a stand on this issue. So you have hotel chains saying, OK, we're going to open our doors to allow protesters to take showers or take a rest. You have other restaurants that are deciding to take a stand. And then there's pressure on other companies who are in Hong Kong for them to take a stand. And I think it's a difficult question, right, because some of them are not wanting to take a stand one side or the other because they have business in China and they're fearing consequence if they take a stand in favor of Hong Kong democracy. On the other hand, on this kind of issue, I think it's really hard to say you don't have to take a moral stand. So that's, I think, that's the background of this issue coming up. And then you can get into more details about assault weapons and Salesforce or abortion rights and entertainment companies that are saying, okay, should we do business in Georgia, et cetera.
Tom, give us your sense on the push by these CEOs really to step up and make a strong statement on a variety of these issues.
Well, I think there's several different forces at work. I think a lot of these CEOs do feel a moral responsibility to speak out on important issues. And, of course, at the same time, they realize that what they do publicly has some impact on the market performance of the company. So they really do have to balance these things. I want to mention some results from the first study I'm aware of that's actually tried to gather some empirical evidence about how these things play out. And this is work by Mike Toffel at Harvard Business School and Ronnie Chatterjee at Duke. And they conducted an experiment where they looked at what was the impact when Apple CEO Tim Cook spoke out against possible policies that would discriminate against lesbians and gays. And they found that when Cook spoke out, that influenced people's opinions, but really no more than did a similar, totally unattributed statement. So it wasn't clear that CEOs had some special cachet in trying to influence public opinion, but it did influence people to be more interested in purchasing iPhones. So these kinds of statements function as marketing statements as well as political statements. And my presumption is that CEOs think very, very carefully before they venture out into this space.
Well, I would think, Tom, that, that part of this is also we are seeing in general more of a of an interest, of a need by retail, by other various sectors out there, to be more aware of the consumer's feelings, thoughts on a variety of topics. And obviously part of that plays into their experience in the store, but now we're taking it a couple of steps further in going outside of the store as well.
I think it is consumer attitudes, but maybe even more importantly, employee attitudes, because companies, big companies today realize there are business benefits from having a diverse workforce. So they understand that quite deeply, and they want to have a diverse workforce, and they want to have a workplace where people feel welcome. They don't want to recreate the sort of narrowly focused workforce of 50 years ago.
Eric?
Yeah, well, I think that's exactly right. So I think one thing that you are seeing here is a question of what the nature of the firm is. So you can't really just it's not a very good business practice or a very practical one for a CEO to just say, I'm just going to look at the numbers. I'm going to look at what the shareholders think. I'm going to try to maximize that number. Even if you're going to take that point of view, as Tom's indicating, you have to care about what do your employees think and what do your customers think, because that's what's going to drive things. So you really have to have a broader conception of what the firm is and who the firm or the CEOs who are leading the firm owe a responsibility to. And they have to, I think, remain both morally aware about what their customers are thinking and what their employees are thinking. And then on some occasions, as we're talking about here, politically aware. And if people are really going to be uncomfortable if you're doing business in a place that is discriminatory based on sexual orientation or gender identity, or is taking a really extreme view about an anti-abortion position, and your employees are going to be upset about that, and then potentially going to have a boycott from consumers who are going to be upset about that, then if you're a CEO, you want to get ahead of that issue. And as Tom's indicating, too, in a lot of these cases, if you if your politics or your moral judgments are lining up with the customers that you have and the employees that you have, that is going to help your business, long-term business success, even if you're just measuring it on a bottom-line basis.
But then you're also talking about the culture within the company as well, especially if you're talking about the feelings and mindset of the employees.
Right.
And we know that corporate culture today is being looked at in a much more close fashion in terms of companies wanting to make sure that a company runs smoothly, but people get along as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and as Tom was indicating, this is really important from a point of view of how you're managing employees. But if you also look at polls, the new generation of millennials is much more concerned about this. So they're much more sensitive, younger generation, to what is the position their companies are taking. So you've seen cases where Google employees will start pressing the company for what are you doing about X, Y, or Z. So companies are really changing in that respect, and they're changing in part from a generational pressure from their new employee, from younger employees and from younger customers.
Tom?
So I want to point to two things. One, I think part of the reason that CEOs feel increasingly that they have to participate in politics is that our political system is so dysfunctional. It used to be that CEOs could kind of step back. They really didn't want to be in the political limelight, and they felt like the political process would address important social issues. And increasingly, the American political process just does not reflect the views of the majority of Americans.
Right.
And that sort of simmering discontent, I think, pushes corporations more and more to take a political role. So that's one factor. But then as we're kind of coming to realize, a lot of the polarity within the United States is primarily urban versus rural in terms of basic political outlook. When you think about the companies that are doing well in the United States, they're all urban-based, just about. I mean, Walmart is a little different, but if you think about knowledge-intensive corporations, mm-hmm. IT companies, finance companies, all the big drivers of the U.S. economy, they're urban-based. These urban dwellers have attitudes that are aligned with what Eric was just describing as millennial in outlook. You know, they're much more cosmopolitan, they're open, they're tolerant, they like diversity, they like other countries, they're welcoming to immigrants, they understand that people from other countries bring a lot of value to the workplace. You know, Silicon Valley probably couldn't function without a vast number of really smart people from other countries who have come here to be part of our tech economy. So CEOs speak out on these diversity issues because their employee base needs them. They need to be able to continue hiring these folks.
So then let's switch to the instance of Salesforce, with the fact that they have basically gone out and told several companies that may sell weapons that they do not agree with, that they want them to stop selling those weapons or stop using their software. So there brings in an interesting dynamic that Salesforce has already built some sort of a relationship, business relationship with a particular company, Tom, and now they are going back and saying, okay, we do not like X or Y, stop it or stop using our software.
So again, I think about this tension or potential tension between what does a CEO or corporation feel like it needs to do on a moral basis. So this is one of those situations where sensible gun control regulations are supported by the vast majority of Americans, Democrat and Republican. And they're largely frustrated because the NRA is such a powerful and highly mobilized political force, not to mention corrupt, but you know, we can get into that later if we want to. And so the Salesforce folks are surely thinking, well, morally, I may need to step into this breach. But again, I think it's an employee-driven thing, and they're calculating this is more important for us retaining the employees we want than it is to keep the business of a relatively small segment of one market.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, I agree with everything Tom just said, but I think that another feature of this issue is a concept that it's not just the moral responsibility of a firm and its decision to sell something. So on the assault weapons issue, you have in the post-Parkland, and you had Dick's Sporting Goods and you had Walmart step away from selling assault weapons. And so they took a stand. And in Salesforce's case, what you have is a question of what one of my colleagues is doing a lot of work on. One of my colleagues here at Wharton, Amy Seppenwall, is doing work on the idea of complicity. So it's not just a question of what you're doing, but are you helping somebody else do something? So an example would be, are you selling identification technology, high-tech witness facial recognition technology to China, which is using that to sort of oppress people in various regions of China, then you're complicit. You're not actually making the decision, but it's your technology, and you have a responsibility for that technology. So that's what Salesforce is saying, is they're taking a moral position. And it's not surprising to me because Salesforce has been a leader in this already. One example is there have been a lot of discussion about comparison in disparities in pay between men and women. So Salesforce just took it upon itself not only to support laws in that respect, but the CEO just said, well, let's do a top-to-bottom review within our company to look at pay for men and pay for women, and basically evened it out. So looked at are we out of step here or not. So you can see that, okay, that's a pretty big signal as we're talking about before to the employees. But on this issue, I think also he's probably the CEO is looking to employee attitudes. As Tom indicated, there's a very broad consensus that some sort of a sensible gun control legislation makes sense. It's not getting any political salience. So there's a lot of pressure for him to take this position. And the truth is, if you're helping a company to sell assault weapons with your technology, you are complicit in that. And so that's what he's saying is saying, wait, we're not going to do that. We're not going to play. We're not going to help you sell assault weapons, because that then the blood is on our hands as well as on the hands of the company that's actually selling the weapons.
And Tom, that's where that with Salesforce, they have an acceptable use policy, which I think is a key ingredient to note here in the fact that it basically it lays out what the expectations they have of the use of that software.
It's very interesting because it parallels in some ways the increased responsibility for supply chains that companies have taken on, you know, probably since the protests against Nike and sweatshop labor 20 years ago. So corporations both back in their supply chain and forward into the people they sell to are now adopting these socially conscious codes that were just unheard of 30 years ago. It's really quite a remarkable shift.
Eric?
Yeah, and I think it's going to continue. I mean, I think as the world gets complex and as the sensibility of consumers and customers and expectations of what companies are going to be doing and what they should be doing, that's not going to disappear. So companies really, you know, these are not going to be easy positions for companies to take. Obviously, they are not going to want to, and I think there's not really an argument they should take a position on every kind of issue out there.
Right.
But on some issues, you see companies starting to push the envelope here, and I think it's a necessary point of view because the underpinnings of a free enterprise system depend on some basic framework agreements. And that's why I think that's one important issue that's coming up more and more is like, well, if you believe in a free enterprise system, then why are you selling high-tech technologies to China? Or if you believe in a free enterprise system, how come you're not supporting the Hong Kong democracy movement, which is basically about preserving rule of law? And then other issues I think are more controversial, but another example just to throw on the table is Patagonia recently said, we're not going to – we made $10 million on the tax law. So the new tax law benefited a lot of corporations, including Patagonia. And they said, we made $10 million on this, but we don't agree with the tax law.
Right.
So we're taking this $10 million and we're devoting it to climate change. Okay, you know, they're forward on environmental kinds of issues. But I think more and more you're going to see I mean, I'm a green consumer, so I like Patagonia. That makes me like them better. I'll probably buy more Patagonia stuff for that reason. And so you're going to see the same kind of thing. Someone who really cares about issues of pay equality and is against assault weapons policies that have not changed the United States is going to really like working for Salesforce, right? So I think that kind of issue is going to continue to percolate, and I think it's a good thing. You know, we should be talking about what is the corporate political responsibility that firms owe.
Tom?
Eric raises a couple of really important issues that I want to follow up on and highlight. So talking about the underpinnings of the free enterprise system, people still read and talk about Milton Friedman's old 1972 piece in the New York Times Magazine where he argued that the social responsibility of firms is to maximize profits, period. Well, that relies on a notion that firms are subject to a reasonable set of laws and regulations that set the rules of the game in a fair and responsible manner. It assumes that firms aren't secretly controlling those rules of the game. And I really worry that we've gotten to a point in our country where firms and very wealthy individuals have an enormous amount of control over the rules of the game. And a lot of that is non-transparent. So these Citizens United type rulings that have allowed dark money to emerge make it very, very hard to tell when a company is speaking out of both sides of its mouth. So you get companies that will say, we support climate policy, stronger climate regulations, and then they go to Washington, D.C. and spend substantial sums of money lobbying against climate policy. And often they do that through trade associations like the Chamber of Commerce and the National Association of Manufacturers, which have been steadfastly against climate policy for many years. And so now progressive companies are finding themselves in the crosshairs because some of them are still members of these trade associations like NAM and like the Chamber that are taking positions that are opposed to what the companies themselves believe. And the question is, will these companies have the fortitude to leave those trade associations in order to make a point, or are they going to be seen as essentially hypocritical for saying one thing and then spending their money to do the opposite?
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with everything that Tom just said. But one added point: it's sometimes thought that this argument for companies to be more political or more moral is just kind of left or liberal, that kind of thing.
Right.
And we have to remember, and I'm just picking up on one thing that Tom said, that the fact is that untransparently, there has been a lot of influence politically that has been under the radar, that companies have been political in lots of ways. So just look at the fossil fuel industry and its attempts to create science that's not really science on climate change, or to lobby against any kind of sensible regulation on climate change. Another book that I've just read is by Nancy McLean called Democracy in Chains, and she traces exactly the kind of thing that Tom's been talking about, particularly with the Koch brothers' influence on setting the ideological agenda for what the rules of the game are. So when you realize that there's politics on both sides here,
sure,
it's not a neutral world where somehow businesses have been neutral and that both sides are staying out of it. In fact, there are very strong forces at work on the other side who basically want to destroy any kind of regulation and basically let off, kind of have a radical free market point of view about things. So this is not a neutral game somehow that we're now seeing. It's a recognition that there is a need for companies to take a forward point of view and to make up their own minds on what the right thing to do is in different cases.
Do you think, Tom, then that these types of moves can have a truly significant impact on our country, on our culture, how we do business, how we approach doing business long term? And I think that's the key word, because in many cases, you will see something come forward. You will see an impact for for 5 years, 10 years, whatever it might be, and then it kind of dwindles down. But do you think that this can carry long term?
I do think it's part of a movement that is going to continue long term and eventually succeed. But I think it is going to take extended pressure. The Supreme Court decisions that have allowed dark money to proliferate, I think, are just a disaster, and that's going to have to be changed through legislation. So it's going to require long-term building of a movement for transparency around corporate political action. I think stockholders and stakeholders deserve to know what companies are doing to manipulate the political system. And I can't think of any legitimate argument for allowing them to do that behind closed doors in the dark. So I think we need a long-term movement for transparency around corporate and rich individual political action. And we need to make a lot more of this stuff clear to the public. And, as people have long said, sunlight is the best disinfectant. Let's try to get the corruption out of our system by bringing more light to bear on it.
Yeah, and I agree that we need more corporate disclosure. One might note that in the Citizens United case that was divided 5-4, all 9 of the justices were in favor of regulation that would increase transparency.
Uh-huh.
And the one last point that goes a little bit deeper on this issue is that it really does matter what your theory of the firm is, right? So what is a firm for? And it's not on one side, there's this idea that government regulation is all bad, it should be reduced to nothing, and that a radically free enterprise system doesn't really require any kind of government framework or rule of law or democracy, for that matter. I mean, I think that the title of a book I mentioned, Democracy in Chains, I think this ideology is actually anti-democracy. They're fine with, if we transform into an authoritarian state, or you're doing business with China, which is an authoritarian state, there's really no problem as long as they're pro-business. But I think that another theory of the firm goes back to some of these progressive values that Tom's mentioning of transparency and the fact that if you're a business, you have a public obligation to be in compliance with what the rules of the game are, and right. that those rules of the game are set by a democratic government that has free elections and is not subject to authoritarian rules. And I think that kind of message of patriotism for companies, that you really do have to take a position on that. That's that's why I raised the Hong Kong case.
Right.
It's not a neutral issue that you have. This has been a battle that's been being fought in the world for a long time. It's a battle between free enterprise that's based in democracies of the world and businesses that are coming up and becoming very successful that are based in authoritarian regimes where there's no rights, there's no free press, et cetera, there's no free judiciary from the political process. So that's a battle that's continuing, and I don't think business can remain neutral in that.
Right.
You're taking a side one way or another. And if you take the side of the authoritarian regimes, you could really end up in a pretty dark place, and you can be complicit in terrible crimes as a result of that.
Great having you both with us. Thank you, Tom, for your time today and your insight.
It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. Eric, great to see you again. Thanks for coming in. Eric Ortz from here at the Wharton School. Tom Lyon from the University of Michigan. We will take a break. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Kate Fazzini of CNBC, formerly of the Wall Street Journal, to talk about her new book, Kingdom of Lies, which delves into the area that she covers on a daily basis, cybercrime, cybersecurity. She'll join us next. Sirius XM 132 Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School.